So, talk number two. We reverence the Buddha, the perfectly enlightened one, the shower of the way. We reverence the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha, which leads from darkness to light. We reverence the Sangha, the fellowship of the Buddha's disciples, that inspires and guides. So I'll begin this talk with a story, which is 27 years ago, starts 27 years ago. And that was my ordination at Gukhyaloka, 1990. So I was ordained with Paramabandhu and Maitreya Bandhu and other luminaries in the order like that. And it was a very, very good year, I must say. It was the first year that we wore robes. It had never been done before. And we came back and found that there was this sort of storm in Shabda. There weren't Twitter storms in those days because it didn't exist. But there was a storm in Shabda about the sort of robe wearing and all the rest of it. And we just said, well, it was just nice. You know, we liked it. We kind of got into the swing of it. But in those days, they were proper traditional type robes, Theravada robes, but in blue. They looked really good. It was a very good year. And I was really looking for, I was 31 in those days, sort of felt, you know, I was a really young, going for it kind of guy. I was really looking forward to my ordination course because it had taken an enormous amount of time for me to prepare for ordination. 3 years. And which at the time seemed, you know, what was the matter with the ordination team? They need to be getting their spectacles on. You know, I'd asked and a year later I hadn't been ordained. And I was quite baffled by all that, really, because it was obvious to me, you know. So I was really up for it, and looking forward to all the meditation and the puja and the study, studying the Bodhicharyavatara and all those sorts of things. It was a real high point of my life, I must say. I really loved a lot of the course. I loved the program and everything that we did, and I loved the valley because, of course, I'd never seen it before. I didn't want to see the valley before my ordination course, and that was such a good thing to do. And then things started to go wrong a bit, really, because in those days until recently, we ordained people halfway through, and that's how it worked. So yeah, quite a good, you know, couple of months to kind of really get into your practice. And I was getting into my practice and getting on well. Subhuti and Suvadra were leading the course, and Padmavadra was supporting. It was a great team in every way. Mokshapriya. And I was definitely going deeper. But there was a problem in that throughout the course I was being stalked. I was being stalked throughout the course by an unnamed person called Doubt. I had a lot of doubt come up. And I come from a traditional white working class background where if you have problems or difficulties, you don't talk about them. You just sort of shove them away and carry on as if they weren't there. I've worked with that kind of stuff in the last 27 years, but back then I was still doing a lot of that, really, I think, looking back. And this thing just was around on the retreat, and it was doubt. And the doubt really was about, am I being ordained into a proper Buddhist order? Or is it some sort of hippie outfit? Sort of hippie-ish thing that's not really a real deal. And that had been around for a few years before my ordination, but it started to really become quite a big theme on the retreat. And my preceptor was Subhuti. I had a lot of faith in him. This thing wouldn't go away, and it started to become a real problem. And I think a couple of weeks before my actual private ordination, it was a major issue. And of course, I wasn't telling anyone about it. I was just keeping it all to myself, dealing with it myself. Anyway, one day it reached a climax. The weather was very beautiful. I used to like going out walking in the afternoon, the heat of the afternoon. I was walking along a forest path, and it stepped out in front of me. It was like a kind of monster just in the path in front of me. It was huge. and it could not be ignored, like the monster of doubt. And I couldn't get past it. I just thought, I'm making a huge mistake. I had a son at the time, still have. He was seven then, and he was very upset with me going away for 4 months, and took, you know, a few years before he really got over that. We've got a very good relationship. We've always had a good relationship, but he really missed me and felt abandoned, you know. I knew that was kind of, that was bothering me a bit. And I just suddenly thought, oh, I'm going to go home. I'm going to go home now. I'm going to leave. I'm not going to do this. I've got all these doubts, you know. I can't do this. I'd never have guessed that I'd be called the King of Faith, because I felt like the King of Doubt at the time. Vichy Kitcher Raja. You know, the King of Doubt. That's how it felt at the time. It was a real monster. It was very, very painful. And I was keeping it all to myself. So it wasn't like I didn't have good friends. I had very good friends, but I just didn't want to tell them. So what I decided to do, I did a little pact with myself. I thought, well, I know what I'll do. I'll go ahead with this ordination. I'll go through with it. And then when I get home, I'll just resign, you know. That's what I'll do. That's how I'll deal with it. I'll just resign. So that's what I did. I went through with it. But the resignation bit never happened. That was the interesting thing. What was really fascinating about this doubt was I went for my private ordination, and afterwards, probably 2 weeks or something afterwards, I had not thought about doubt at all. It hadn't been there. It didn't exist. It just completely disappeared. I was given the Shakyamuni sadhana, which was an absolute wonderful thing. And I've held it very close to my heart for the last 27 years. It's the most precious thing in my life. I can honestly say that. And receiving that sadhana, and all the doubt just completely disappeared. And I just completely, the whole idea of resigning just seemed ridiculous. Ridiculous idea. But I reflected on it for many years afterwards. I thought, what was that all about? Because it was so real. And I don't remember resolving it. You know, this thing, is this a proper Buddhist thought? I don't remember resolving that. But it got resolved in the process of the private ordination. By the time we got to the public ordination, you know, I was really, really happy. And I've been really happy in the order ever since, actually, 27 years. It's gone deeper. I've had my ups and downs like everybody else, but nothing like that. So I had many years to reflect on all that, what that really was. So I've got something to say a little bit about doubt as a result of some of that, and reflecting and talking and hearing people's stories over the years around doubt. And looking at the Buddhist tradition, its traditional teachings around doubt, the Buddhist tradition is pretty clear about doubt and what that is. It's one of the 5 hindrances, you know, one of the hindrances to meditation, hindrances to practice even. And if you look in, you know, traditional texts like the Visuddhimagga, the Path of Purity, it's very well documented and written about and understood what that really is. I'm not going to go into all those traditional things here and now. But what I will say is that doubt does sometimes cripple us on the path. It can definitely cripple you. It can dog you. It can stalk you. It can get in the way. It can feel very uncomfortable sometimes. Here we are, we're fully paid up Buddhists. We might be committed, or feel we're getting committed or interested, but up comes these sort of doubts. And they can be a real hindrance. They really can get in the way. Can make things very painful. So I want to make just one point about doubt before I move on to more traditional material on Shraddha. I think we need to learn to value our doubts. That's the point I want to make. I certainly didn't back then. This thing was something to be got away from and dispensed with as quickly as possible. It was very, very painful. But I think we need to embrace doubt and even value it and use it creatively when it arises. I think if we face our doubts honestly and explore them, it can lead to real spiritual rigour and depth. What's good about doubt is if you've got a doubt about something, like I had a doubt about our order and whether it's pucker or not, I did actually do an enormous amount of work in the years up to my ordination on actually checking out our order and its authenticity, if you like, and what that really is. One of the great things about doubt is it gets you to really go into that area and really look at it and really explore it with real depth and thoroughness in a way which you might not do otherwise. You might not be interested enough in a particular area, because Buddhism's so vast, isn't it? There are so many areas that you can look at. But doubt's quite useful in that regard, in that you've got a doubt about something. Well, let's go into it. Let's check it out. Let's explore it and reassure ourselves or not, as the case may be. You might have doubts about the law of karma. You might have doubts about rebirth. You might have doubts about meditation. You might have doubts about Sangha Akshita. And, you know, my own particular favourite is Tri Ratna a real Buddhist tradition? That was my particular kind of doubt. What's yours? Have you had one? What's your doubt? So, that's the point, really. Acknowledge, even value your doubts. Don't be afraid of them. See them as a friend. They can be a real spiritual friend. Yeah, because otherwise we're running scared. We can run scared of our doubts. But actually, they get us to do some real spiritual work, which leads to depth. So I'd like to move on now a bit to the three traditional kinds of Shraddha. And these are Shraddha, which is a lucid mind, trusting Shraddha, Shraddha that trusts, and thirdly, longing Shraddha, Shraddha that longs. And these emanate from Asanga. Asanga is one of the great figures, Tibetan figures, on the refuge tree. If you don't know what the refuge tree is, you can check it out here. But he's definitely one of the great teachers that influence and are fed into the Tri Ratna Buddhist order. And he was a great systematizer of the teachings. And he wrote the Abhidharma Samuchaya, which is a sort of systematic account of the Abhidharma, that brand of Buddhism, that basket of Buddhism, which systematizes the teachings and mental states, particularly according to the Yogacara school of Mahayana Buddhism. So he's an important figure. And so when he goes into Shraddha and looks at what Shraddha really is, he really got something useful to say. He's really thought about it. He's really practiced. So what he says about Shraddha is, and here we go, Shraddha is clarity, trust and longing for those things which have value, are real and are possible. I'll repeat that. Shraddha is clarity, trust and longing for those things which have value, are real and are possible. So this is a very neat definition because, well, you can really explore it and go into it. So it's kind of three dimensions of Shraddha that he's talking about here. And the first one is obviously the lucid mind aspect. So let's be clear what that is. So a Shraddha that is clear and has a lucid heart or mind. It's interesting, the word here is citta. Citta in Buddhism means heart and mind. Heart and mind, if you like. It's interesting that in Buddhism they're not separated. They're coterminous, heart and mind. So the Sanskrit word for clear and lucid is prasada, which is a very beautiful word, actually. and it means serenity and confidence. So when you find what is of real value to you and real quality, i.e. the three jewels, that's a very beautiful thing. Yeah, you have a bright feel about you, a bright conscience about you. It's calm, it's surreal, serene I should say. Yeah, you have a serene mind and consciousness. When you really see the three jewels and really value them and appreciate them, you become clear and bright and lucid in your mind. That's how it works. It's a kind of dhyana-like state, if you know what that is. And all the different parts of your consciousness kind of come together in this clear, serene, a bit like mountain, looking at clear water in a mountain stream. You can really see through. There's a refreshing, clear feel about it. So if you found what's deep and satisfying and meaningful for you, it's a strongly aesthetic experience. It's aesthetic. I looked up aesthetic in the dictionary again, because we use it very often. I thought, well, what does it really mean? I think I know what it means. And it says it's concerned with beauty and the appreciation of beauty. And it's from the Greek aestheticos, aestheticos. Dharmapriya will probably correct me if I have not pronounced that correctly. So if we get an experience of Shraddha, which is a lucid mind, in a puja or in meditation or even on a pilgrimage, yeah, we can really appreciate and savour it. If you find one of those, remember it, think about it, reflect upon it, yeah, because it's likely to be deep and subtle and beautiful. It's crucial we don't forget these experiences, because they are very inspiring. When they occur, they're inspiring. I had one at Bodh Gaya, quite unexpected actually. I had one in the toilets at Bodh Gaya. People don't usually talk about the toilets at Bodh Gaya. You know, they talk about the Mahabodhi temple, they talk about the rupas, the chanting and all the rest of it. But I was actually in the toilet, and and that's where it occurred. Completely surprising. I just felt all this incredible clarity and joy about my life and what I was doing, and everything just seemed to fit into place, and in a way that I really wasn't expecting. And then I had a pee, you know. But it was just not what I expected to happen at all. But there I was. I thought, this isn't an ordinary visit to the toilet. This is a toilet at Bodh Gaya. So it's crucial we don't forget these experiences, because they're about the three jewels, the beauty of the three jewels. Secondly, trusting Shraddha. What's that? What do we trust? What's a faith, a Shraddha that trusts? And this is the form of Shraddha which is based in deep conviction. It's deep conviction. So when I was saying to you yesterday, well, what are the Buddhist teachings that you really trust, that you really have confidence in, and why do you have confidence in them? That's moving into this kind of territory. So, for instance, for me, the teaching of impermanence is very, very clear to me. I can see it everywhere. But I don't know anybody else in the religious world that talks about it, other than the Buddha. Perhaps there are people, but we talk about it all the time in Buddhism. It's such an important and deep teaching, and it cannot be denied. It is true, and it will always be true. I was reading recently about, I read an article in New Scientist magazine about ending the end of death, and how scientists feel that they can. We're on the brink of prolonging human beings' lives for an indefinite period of time, possibly. I thought, no, I just know that's not true, is it? No matter what you do with robotics and all, no, I don't think so. That's going to happen. You're having yourselves on. You're very clever people, but you're having yourselves on. I don't think that's how reality is. So a deep conviction, particularly a conviction in a Dharma truth, that you're really living your life on that basis. So it might be the truth of the efficacy of compassion, the importance of compassion, in the world. I really believe in that, for instance. So this is especially mentioned by Asanga. One of the areas that he thinks you should really reflect upon is the truth of the law of karma. In this regard, the truth of the law of karma, which is why I've handed you out a Wheel of Life. There's a lot more going on in the Wheel of Life than just the law of karma, but it's there. It's definitely there. So you are convinced with the law of karma, you're convinced that actions really do have consequences. Yeah. Sometimes I behave, I've noticed, as if actions don't have consequences. If I eat 3 pieces of cake that I won't put any weight on. And it's not true. I do put weight on if I eat 3 pieces of cake. But I act as if sometimes it's not going to happen. It's ridiculous. And I know that's ridiculous. And sometimes I eat 3 pieces of cake for weeks on end, you know. And still think that I won't put weight on. But, you know, the reality is that I have. So actions have consequences. You're convinced of that. And you're convinced that skillful actions lead to happiness and well-being for yourself and others. It leads to skillful mental states. Yeah. Skillful actions lead to skillful mental states for yourself and for other people. You're convinced of that. You're also convinced that unskillful actions cause harm to you and to yourself and other people. Again, I've noticed that with myself. I sometimes think, well, if I just sort of bend the truth here, kind of in this for the sake of a good story, that won't have a negative consequence, but it will. Sometimes I can act as if, you know, it's okay to just sort of fib a little bit, just for the sake of a good story. So watch out for this. Watch out for this sort of thing. Reflect on the law of karma for yourself. You're convinced of the truth of what we call pratita samutpada, or conditioned co-production, or conditionality. There's lots of different terms for it. And that you're actually living on that basis. If not completely all of you, but a good chunk of you is behaving as if that really is what you think. So we can reflect on our actions. We can reflect on how we have changed since we have gone for refuge to the Three Jewels. We can notice the actual effects of our skillfulness and unskillfulness in our lives. And we can study and reflect on conditioned co-production. And in this way, this form of shraddha becomes very grounded in our experience. Yeah, it becomes part of how we are, how we think and see the world. So that's the shraddha of truth. So this is trusting shraddha. It's a deep conviction of the Buddha's teachings. It can't be doubted, it can't be fudged or got away from. It's something that you deeply believe. I had an interesting experience of this many years ago. I think I might have been 21, perhaps 21, yeah. And I first came across an image of the Tibetan Wheel of Life. I'd never seen it before. I had a friend in Cambridge who was part of, he was a disciple of Atto Rinpoche, who I was also a disciple of for a while before I came along to Tri Ratna. And I saw the Tibetan version of, you know, the traditional looking one. I remember it just being, I was walking towards a kitchen carrying some cups at the time, and it was on a wall. And I just stopped and I saw it. And I looked at it and I was really quite fascinated, and I asked a friend of mine, and he was a Buddhist. I said, what is that? And he spent the next 20 minutes just explaining some of it to me and what it was about. And there and then I felt, this is the best explanation of human life that I've ever encountered, and I want to know more. I think that was actually a factor in me getting involved in Tri Ratna, because I didn't actually get that good an explanation from the Tibetan tradition, but I did when I came here. So I drew that for the Sangha in India. But it was really fascinating doing the actual drawing, because I got to really, really reflect on the images and what they represent, what it really means. So this is all coming out of trusting Shraddha, trusting the Dharma. I think I found the Wheel of Life quite horrifying, actually, in some aspects when I first came across it. But then I reflected, well, a lot of life is horrifying, actually. There's some pretty horrifying things happening in the world. There's also some really wonderful things going on. And the potential for that to grow and grow is pretty big. Thirdly, we've got longing Shraddha. Another beautiful word here, Sanskrit word, Abhilasha. Abhilasha is longing Shraddha. It's a very strong word, and it indicates an intense longing. It's an intense experience. Not everybody experiences this, but when you do, if you do, you will know. The traditional image that's used is an interesting one. It's the intense longing that the lover feels for the arms of the beloved, yeah, who is far away. You might have had that experience. You might have had that experience where there's someone that you're definitely in love with and they're a long way away. You can't be with them, but you really, really want to be. I think there are issues with that particular image in relation to this. But, you know, you get the feeling from it. You get the feeling. If you can kind of transpose that feeling onto the Dharma in a clean way, you get the kind of level of intensity that there might be. So that's a traditional image. And it's described as a longing to leave suffering, longing to leave dukkha, and the unpleasant, painful and deluded aspects of life, and to, you know, reach the arms of, as it were, of nirvana. You really feel that. It's not, well, Buddhism's good, I'm making progress, and sometime, somewhere in some future life, I'll gain enlightenment. It's not like that. You're really intensely wanting to go for refuge and deepen and experience nirvana for the sake of all beings. Only nirvana will satisfy you. You see through the games that you play in life, and you long for the beauty and majesty and fulfillment of nirvana. That's longing Shraddha. A very good example of this is Milarepa, you know, the Tibetan sage Milarepa, the one that had to build the towers, all the towers, and then tear them all down again to purify his karma. You know, the man who'd been very evil, in that he killed a lot of people, and had some very weighty karma, which he had to purify. But he did all that, and spent years living in caves, living on nettles, and turned green, apparently, because of the nettles. Very interesting. And, he had his teacher, Marpa, who he longed to see. There were times when he was on his own for years on end, longed to see his guru, his teacher. So in Tibetan Buddhism, there's even a genre of literature called The Cry of Longing to the Guru from Afar. That's what it's called. And some of the songs of Milarepa really, really exemplify this. There's one, I'll read some of it out to you. He's singing a song of longing to see his guru, Marpa. And it's an expression of a powerful drive to leave the samsara, the wheel of life, and follow the spiral path to the end. So here we go. Though limited in reverence, I wish to see you. Though weak in faith, I wish to join you. The more I meditate, the more I long for my guru. Though short my diligence, I have need for learning. Though poor my perseverance, I wish to practice. The more I contemplate, the more I think of you. The more I meditate, the more I think of my guru. So this longing song isn't just about Milarepa wanting to see his teacher, like Sanghanista might say to me, oh, it'd be good to see you, Sataraja. It's not like that, you know. I'm sure he's very sincere when he says that, but it's not like that. it's a real desire for the bliss of nirvana. Milarepa wishes to experience the bliss of nirvana that Marpa is experiencing. He really longs for that. And Marpa is the personification of that for him. So it's very, very useful for Milarepa in that regard. It's not just a notion. It's just not. It's not an idea. Yeah, it's something really real and very, very strong for him. And that's what trusting Shraddha is like. Longing Shraddha is like. It's a real longing. It's not a weak thing. You really, really feel it. I was just having a walk with Trinakarin after breakfast. I'm sure he won't mind me saying. He was just saying how much he really wanted to come here to Kamaloka and be on retreat. And I felt the same way as well. I really wanted to come. And what a good thing it is when that happens, when you feel it. Sometimes it's a bit frustrating when you can't. Last week I was working nights on the ward in a mental hospital. I didn't want to be there. I wanted to be here. And now I am here. And what a good thing that is. It's good when we long, actually, in that kind of way. You're really feeling something. It's very alive in you. So, it is possible. Yeah, that longing for something that is possible. We can actually grow and develop and attain higher states. We can leave the realm of dukkha and craving. It is possible to follow the path and attain enlightenment. It might all seem very distant sometimes to us, but we can glimpse the distant summit of the mountain from where we currently stand. This is longing Shraddha. Sadly, I think it does seem that this intense desire for enlightenment has become lost in some traditional forms of Buddhism in the East, particularly monastic Buddhism. Some of the monasteries in Thailand, Myanmar, Sri Lanka, India, Tibet. This sometimes happens, according to Sangharakshita, has happened. The established lifestyle in the monastery becomes the thing, and not going for refuge to the three jewels. That kind of fades a bit. Certainly, Bhante came across this a lot in India, and he coined this term ecclesiastical corporation, where you've got a kind of church there, you've got a group of people who, on the face of it, are, you know, wishing to gain enlightenment and moving in that direction, but may not actually be. This is very interesting. I was just reflecting on this. One of these weird little coincidences. I came on the train to Norwich Station. I got off the train, and there in front of me were two orange-robed Theravada monks right on Norwich Station. And I thought, oh, right, two monks, right. Are we in the same tradition? Are we doing the same thing? I don't know. I'd have to talk to them. Maybe they were. Maybe they weren't. I don't know. But they looked like Buddhists, and I didn't. I just looked like somebody, anybody. They looked like Buddhists. Who knows? I did come across a Burmese, a Myanmar monk at Bodh Gaya 4 years ago. And we had a chat, and he's quite good English. And he said, well, we can't be like the Buddha. He is like God, he said. But we can be better people than we are. I don't know, maybe I misunderstood him or something, I don't know. But it seemed to be a bit like that, that he was sort of, maybe, for me, I said, well, no, we can get enlightenment, there's no question. He didn't seem to, he was like, I don't know. But the teaching really for us is to remember that enlightenment is the goal, and we need to long for it. There's a German philosopher and writer called Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, and I work in mental health, and there's a particular quote which is a real mantra in mental health, but I think it's relevant here. He says, treat a man as he is and you make him worse than he is. Treat a man as if he already is what he could be and you make him what he should be. Enough said. When we say treat a man, we mean treat ourselves. Yeah, we can be much more than what we currently are. And of course, this is the purpose of order names. Sometimes people have even talked about, well, do we really need names? All these Sanskrit names in the order, it's very inconvenient in ordinary life. But it's a remarkable thing, because when you're given a name, it's a very precious thing, because it's a daily reminder of what you could be. You could be the King of Faith. You could be whatever it is your order name is. It's always a signpost towards something much more than what you currently are. Maybe you've got some of those qualities already, but there's so much more that you could develop, and that's in your name. Every time somebody calls you it, you're reminded, Bodhisattva. You know, what does that mean? And it's a reminder. Most of the time, probably you won't remember that, but there's the possibility of that all the time. Just going back a little bit to, I used the mountain analogy earlier. You know, the mountain peak, we use this quite a lot in Buddhism. You know, we see the peak, that desire for the peak. I kind of looked into this a bit. Sometimes it's useful in Buddhism, that analogy of the mountain peak. But I looked into a little bit of real mountaineering, and I live in Cambridge, and just round the corner from where I live in a community, there used to live this chap called George Mallory. And in 1924, he went on an expedition to Everest he went for the summit with a guy called Sandy, a young guy called Sandy Irvine, and they both died. A lot of people still think they made it to the summit in 1924 with kind of Norfolk tweed jackets on and hobnailed boots, but they really think they made. And in 1999, they found Mallory's body perfectly preserved above the snow line. And not that far from the summit, dead, obviously. And very interesting, they may have actually reached the mountain peak, nobody really knows. But just before he went off, famously a journalist asked him, he said, Mr. Mallory, why do you want to climb Everest? And he said, because it's there. And that was a sort of classic quote which has been used a lot ever since, but he was the person that coined it. He was the first person to see what's called the first step on the western coombe of Everest. I recently heard a radio interview with Chris Bonington, you know, the veteran climber. And he was saying, after, you know, a lifetime of climbing, he said, on a long and difficult climb, he said, it's really, really important you can keep seeing the peak. If you get glimpses of the peak, he said, it changes everything. You're able to keep going under all sorts of difficult conditions. So I kind of think there's something in the mountain analogy with Buddhism, I think. So much then for longing shraddha, on keeping our desire for going for refuge to the three jewels alive. And that means always bearing in mind the Buddha's achievement, and that what the Buddha attained, we too can attain. So these three aspects of shraddha describe a total response to the three jewels, a total response. Shraddha, which is a lucid mind, describes the affective aspect. Yeah, the affective aspect. It draws out the emotional and even devotional and aesthetic aspects. Yeah, the beauty. It shows us this. The affective aspect. Trusting shraddha draws out what we call the cognitive dimension. That is what's concerned with knowing, that we really know something, we cognize. And the longing shraddha indicates the volitional aspect, yeah, which is what moves us. Volitional, we're doing something, we're moving, it's impelling us towards our spiritual ideals. So, you know, we've got the affective, we've got the cognitive, and we've got the volitional. I mean, that is a really big part of us. That's all of us. Yeah. These three aspects add up to our whole being, responding to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha in a really big way. And if the three jewels are to be a true refuge, it needs to satisfy all these aspects of us. Yeah. Or we'll get doubts. Doubts will come up. Every little corner of us needs to be engaged with the spiritual life. If it only appeals to just part of us, that it won't work, it won't satisfy. So the true refuge, the Buddha Dharma Sangha, is vast. It's profound. It's endless. And it can take all of us. All of what we've got, it can take. And much, much more. So I've got some questions for your group. A couple of questions for your group. These are all on the sheets that you'll get on the way out. Which aspect of Shraddha do we mostly resonate with and why? Which aspects of Shraddha do we mostly resonate with and why? And the second question is, how are we getting on with the law of karma and actions having consequences? How are we getting on with that? Yeah. Is it just some sort of weird thing that on a wheel, or how are we getting on with that? The law of karma. Very important. So, to preview my third talk, I'm going to talk about Shraddha and imagination. And then I'm going to talk about 15 ways that we can develop and maintain Shraddha. So I'm going to leave you down with a final reading from the Maha Vastu. Final reading. I love this reading because it goes right to the heart of the matter. So after I finish the reading, that's the end of the talk. So it's called The Buddha's Achievement. The Buddha gazes at the Bodhi tree. Then, at the end of the 7 days, the Exalted One rose from his throne, surveyed the Bodhi tree with a Dāgha's look and with a steady gaze. "Here at the Bodhi tree," said he, "I made an end of the jungle and thicket of the round of rebirth and death, which has no beginning and no end. Here I have broken Mara of the lusts, Mara of death, and Mara of the skandhas. I have broken Mara the deva. Here I have realized the vow I made an infinite kalpa ago. Here at the Bodhi tree, I have won preeminence in the world. I have won primacy in the world. I have won the essence of being." Thank you.